Welcome to another episode of the Criminal Calendar. Although perhaps we shouldn't call it the Criminal Calendar for our session today. Our author is Diana Gabaldon.
Thank you.
We could, though, in time, maybe call you a mystery writer.
Oh, in the fullness of time, though, as far as that goes, there is, in fact, a murder mystery in each one of my books. It's just that it's such a small part of the book as a whole that they aren't classified that way.
Well, I know people don't think of you as a crime writer, but as I recall in the story we'll get into, you started out to write a mystery, and this whole series, in part, was something of an accidental spinoff, which has now
something
taken
like that,
over
yes.
your life. You know, I was thinking, Diana, before we had lunch today, you and I have been together now for 12 years.
At least, yeah.
I opened The Poison Pen in 1989, and you published Outlander in 1991.
That's right, yeah.
But you were being a mystery junkie in and out of the store.
All the time, yeah.
Yeah, and you were reading writers like Ian Rankin.
Oh, yes.
Who are some of the other, I know you came in for Scottish book fixes, which it turned out had a point. Although at the time, I didn't know what it was. But who else did you greatly admire before you yourself got into this and became famous?
Oh, let me see. Well, Reginald Hill, he's a longtime favorite of mine. And Ian, of course, who was sort of a cult favorite. I actually found him in Canada originally. So when I would go up there, I could get books that weren't published in the U.S., and so I would always go through their mystery sections and bring home anything that looked interesting. I'm trying to think who else. I read so much of everybody that it's hard to pick and choose. Let's see, I like a lot of American authors, Nevada Barr, for instance, and I'm trying to think who I've been reading recently. Oh, Dana Stabenow, she's another big favorite. But a lot of the British authors, that's more or less where I started, was with the old classics, you know, Dorothy Lee Sayers, who I always tell people is one of my five role models as far as writing goes, you know, authors whom I've deliberately analyzed and tried to use their techniques. And, you know, I read all of the Agatha Christie's, some of which I liked, some of which I didn't, and I mostly just worked my way through the whole canon, I think. Marjorie Allingham, you name it.
I would think that Allingham would really appeal to you, because she has
much,
a kind of an offbeat aspect to her mysteries.
Very much.
Yeah, very atmospheric and unusually plotted. I know that you are a fan of an author that people don't know so well, known to us as P.F. Chisholm.
Oh, yes.
Known to readers in mainstream as Patricia Finney, because you were kind enough to write an introduction to her fourth mystery, which we published.
Yeah, Plague of Angels. That was a wonderful book. Actually, the whole series was wonderful. She's just got an amazing combination of historical detail and solid characters and amazing absurd humor.
There's a lot. Well, I think of you when I read her. I think there's a lot that the two of you have in common. And she's chosen to place her mysteries not terribly far from where you started with Outlander. She's up on the border country with all those weavers, which we would call horse wrestlers or thieves. But it really was the mystery that you like. So although I've heard the story, I never grow tired of it. How did you come from being a mystery fan and a scientist, because your background is really in the sciences, how did you come to write this time travel imaginative series?
Well, I have always wanted to be a writer. I knew from a very early age that that's what I was supposed to do. And yet I came from a very conservative family background. My father would always say to me, "Well, you're such a poor judge of character, you're bound to marry some bum." So I would.
Okay.
So he said, "So be sure to get a good education so you can support your children." And so with this sort of nudging going on at home, I wasn't about to announce that I was becoming an English major and wanted to write novels, because it had dawned on me that this was kind of a chancy career, that most people who want to write novels never do. Those who do often don't get published, and still sadder, those who get published often don't make a living at it.
Very few. In fact, something like under 17% of people who write and publish can't make enough money to live.
Yeah, I think David Morrell told me there are something like 200 novelists in the U.S. who actually make a living at it, which is not a very reassuring statistic if that's what you want to do. And so with this sort of nudging going on at home, I decided, well, maybe I'll pick something a little more stable, and so I went into science. And I liked science, I was good at it, but I still wanted to be a writer. And so when I got to be 35, I said, well, I think I should try and write a book to find out if I can, because if I can, then I should, and I don't want to wait till I'm 65 and think I should have done it earlier, because what if I turn out to be any good at it? I will have wasted all this time.
Oh, so, I'm sorry you said that. That's a bad omen for me. Well, sorry.
There's always time. And so I said, okay, on my next birthday, which would be my 36th, I will start writing a book. I'm not going to show it to anyone. It's not meant for publication. I just want to learn how. because up to this point I had written all kinds of everything, anything anybody would pay me for, essentially, plus all of the stuff that you have to do in the process of getting a PhD, you know, grant proposals, program analyses, technical articles, scholarly journals, you name it.
Were you doing some web writing? Didn't you have a web newspaper?
Well, no, the web didn't exist at that point. I had what you're probably thinking of is this journal that I started while I was a research professor at ASU called Software Quarterly. It was a quarterly journal for scientists who used computers in their work. And I sort of slid into that one sideways because when the university hired me, they in fact didn't have a complete job description. And they said, well, make up your own research program. And while you're doing that, maybe you could help the assistant director with his data. Because he had 10 years worth of data in his back office. And they said, you have a background in computers, by which they meant that I had one class in Fortran programming, which was one more than anyone else there had, so you can help Bob with his data. So I spent the next 18 months writing Fortran programs to analyze the contents of bird gizzards. And at the end of this, I said, well, there's maybe five other people in the entire world who are interested in bird gizzards, but it would save each one of them 18 months worth of effort if they knew about these programs I'd written. And so the upshot of that was this journal that I started, Science Software Quarterly, which did take off in an amazing way. And in fact, that was my primary job at the university for the next 3 years, was editing and running that journal, which we finally then sold to John Wiley and Sons, and it continued running in one guise or another for another 8 years or so, but not under my control.
Okay, you're right, that is what I was thinking about. But anyway, back to your 36th birthday.
Back to the 36th birthday, yes. Well, anyway, this actually has something to do with it, because it was as a result of this weird little expertise in scientific computation that I had developed that I fell into the CompuServe Literary Forum. That is, I didn't marry a bum, I married a very nice man, but he did quit work 3 months after our first child was born in order to start his own business, which did leave me as our sole support for a while there. And since they don't pay assistant professors all that much, I said, well, what else can I do to earn money here? And it seemed to me that writing was about the only thing I could do, given that by this time we had three children under the age of six. And so I started writing for the computer press, for Byte and InfoWorld and so forth, and that was very profitable. Anyway, in the course of events there, I got a software package to review, and along with it came a trial membership to CompuServe. And the company, Borland it was, said, we understand you're going to be writing a review of our software. And we have not a website, this was before the web actually took off, but we have a forum on CompuServe that supports this software, and we wish you would look at it and mention it in your review. And I said, well, that's totally legitimate, why not? So I logged on, joined CompuServe, went and looked at the site, which is fine, and then I had 4 hours of free connect time left, so I said, what else is in here? And I began looking around, and I came across the literary forum, which was a bunch of people who liked books. And there were a lot of readers in there, but also a lot of writers. There were published writers there. This is the first time I had ever met any, you know, more or less face-to-face.
Exactly.
And also there were a lot of aspiring writers there who would talk about what they wanted to do and all that. Anyway, I had stumbled into this milieu about a year before I made up my mind to begin writing my own book. And when I did decide to write it, I was not going to tell any of these people that I knew what I was up to, because I had seen way too many people talk about what they wanted to do, and then nothing would ever happen. And I said, well, I think I'll just keep my mouth shut until I'm sure I can do it. And so after about a year here, as I said, I made this decision to begin writing a book. So the first question, of course, is what sort of book shall I write, given that this is for practice and not for publication? And so I thought, well, I read everything and lots of it, but maybe more mysteries than anything else. And so I said, well, maybe I should write a mystery. And then I said, well, no, mysteries have plots. I'm not sure I can do that. And so I said, what's the easiest possible kind of book that I could write for practice? So I thought some more. And I said, well, maybe a historical novel, because historical novels have no genre constraints as such. You can do anything from political intrigue to, you know, worm's eye view of the Borgia popes, you know, historical romance at one end of the spectrum, and, you know, Sharon K. Penman's very, very accurate portrayals of real-life events at the other, and everything in between, including historical mysteries, of course. But the only thing that you really need for a historical novel is a good, detailed, sound historical background. And I was fairly sure I could do that because, as I said, I am a research professor. I do have the university library. I can look things up. And so I said, well, all right, I'll write a historical novel. So where shall I set it? Because I have no background in history to speak of, just the 6 hours of Western Civ that they make you take in college. So one time would do as well as another. I'd have to look it all up anyway. So I was casting around looking for a time and a place to set this practice novel, and I happened to see a Doctor Who rerun on public television. I see you're familiar with Doctor Who.
I am very familiar with Doctor Who, yes. I have a daughter who shares your interests, although she's a bit younger. Okay.
Well, we got in the habit of watching Doctor Who when our kids were very little because they all liked it because of the sound effects and everything, and it would keep them quiet just long enough for me to finish doing my nails. So I got in the habit of watching Doctor Who every week and enjoyed the show. But for those who may not know, it's a very, very long-running British show, which in Britain is done as a kid's show. Of course, here it's a cult show.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, the Doctor is a Time Lord from the planet Gallifrey who travels through space and time and collects various companions from different eras of Earth's history. And in this particular show I was watching, it was a very old one, filmed maybe 25 years before, he had a young boy, a 17, 18-year-old kid, who he'd picked up in Scotland in 1745. And this kid appeared in his kilt. And I said, well, that's sort of fetching. And so I was sitting in church the next day thinking about this. And, I don't claim divine revelation, but I was in church. And I said, well, you want to write a book. It doesn't really matter where you set it, because nobody's ever going to see it anyway. The important thing is to pick a point and start in so you can get started on this. So I said, fine, Scotland, 18th century. So that's where I started. You know, no plot, no outline, no characters, and no background either, nothing but the 18th century Scotland and the vision of a man in a kilt.
It's really scary to think the role that chance has played in all of this. I mean, for people who think, that writing is I don't know what I want to say.
Different.
Yeah, a call of genius or that you have to be prepared or whatever. I mean, I think this is a story that is really helpful for people to hear, because many people, I think, who would like to write frighten themselves off.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do. They think, I have to have it all planned out ahead of time. I have to know everything about this book before I even sit down to write. And this is not true at all. All you need is a pencil and paper.
Absolutely. Well, or a computer by today's standards. So had you ever, in fact, been to Scotland?
No, I never had. In fact, I didn't go until after I had a three-book contract. When my agent sold the first book, he got me a three-book contract, and at that point I said to my husband, well, I think I really must go and see the place. So only the first book was written entirely from library research. The others I had been to Scotland for.
Well, you're not without precedent in mystery. Harry Keating wrote his wonderful long-running series about Inspector Gotay, who operates out of Bombay, India, and didn't get to India until he was many novels into the book. But anyway, so here you are, and you are basically writing for practice. And what did you do? You wrote some sections of a book, and?
Well, I was just writing along in bits and pieces, because I didn't have any preset conceptions about how one had to write a book. I had written all kinds of other things, and it had occurred to me that the only way of writing something was just to write it. So I said, well, if I can only see this scene, I'll write this scene, and if I don't know what happens next, well, I'll go write another scene somewhere else, and eventually I'll figure it out. So that's what I was doing. And about 8 months into the writing, I was having a conversation one night with one of my online acquaintances. Now, CompuServe is not a chat room as such. The forums operate as what's called a bulletin board system, where you address a message to a specific other person, and it stays in sight, for a week or several weeks. They sort of scroll through and eventually disappear. But while they're on the board, as we put it, anybody who sees a message can reply to it. So all conversations are essentially public, and consequently you get a great deal of involvement and really interesting conversations going on. But I was working at night back and forth on several projects, and so I would pause periodically and log in as sort of my coffee break. And when I logged in, I would leave a message, and this other person who was also working was doing the same thing. So we were having this conversation over several hours. And essentially, we were talking about what it feels like to be pregnant. And he said, oh, I know what that's like. My wife's had three children. And I laughed electronically, and I said, yeah, Buster, I've had three children. And he said, well, can you tell me what it's like then? And I said, well, I can, but it's sort of complicated to explain in a 30-line message slot. I said, I tell you what, I have this piece that I wrote a few months ago in which a young woman tells her brother what it's like to be pregnant, since he's curious. I said, I'll put that in the data library for you, and you can go read it. The library being where people would put up poems or stories or novel chapters, anything they wanted to share. And so I put this piece up in the library, and everyone who had been following the argument went and read the piece. And they all came rushing back, and they said, well, this is great. What is it? And I said, well, I don't know. And they said, well, where's the beginning? I said, well, I haven't written that yet. And so they said, well, put up some more of it. They said, this is fascinating. We like these people. We want to find out more about them. And so gradually, I began putting up small chunks of the novel. As I say, I don't write in a straight line, so I was not putting up chapters. In fact, I don't have chapters until the last thing before I send the manuscript to my editor. That's what I do, is break it up at that point and title the chapters. But whenever I had 10 pages or so that would kind of stand by themselves without a lot of explanation, I would put it in the library. And people got very interested in these chunks, as they called them, and they'd say, oh, Diana has a new chunk, have you read it? And everyone would run and read the new chunk and come back and discuss it and ask me questions, and I'd answer as well as I could. Anyway, over time, people began saying, well, this is wonderful, you should try and sell it. And I said, well, it's for practice, you know, I don't even know what kind of novel it is, because at this point, a lot of other things had occurred, including the time travel angle, and I realized I was no longer writing a straight historical novel. I said, I don't even know what to call it.
I didn't realize that. So, mm-hmm. So when you began the concept of Claire Randall, World War II, mm-hmm. A nurse, isn't she?
Uh-huh.
Actually stepping through an aperture, if you will, uh-huh. and dropping back into, uh-huh. well, just a little over two centuries,
mm-hmm.
back to Culloden. As a matter of fact, she went back to a battle scene, didn't she?
No.
Is that the opening scene, or did
no.
she get there?
No.
I've forgotten by
no,
now.
No, she arrives in 1743, so we have a
lead-up. So we're not at Culloden.
In fact, Culloden doesn't happen until the second book.
Oh, it doesn't. Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. Well, in any case, mm-hmm. the idea of her moving across the centuries mm-hmm. and all of mm-hmm. that wasn't in your original...
Oh, no. No, as I said, all I had in mind was Scotland, 18th century, and a man in a kilt.
Okay.
So the first thing that I did, of course, was to go to the university library, where I typed Scotland, Highlands, 18th century into the card catalog, and it came up with 38 references, which all had similar call numbers, so I went to the shelf where those were, and here were 400 books on Scotland. You know, geography, costume, history, language, everything. So I just tiptoed along and took out anything that looked interesting. And two or three days of research, just skimming through the books, showed me that in the 18th century, the primary point of conflict would have been the Rising under Bonnie Prince Charlie, the 45, as it was called. And I said, well, the only thing that I know officially about writing novels is that they should have conflict. I said, this looks like a good conflict. Fine, we'll have that as the background then. So I had that, and I said, well, we have the 45 was Scots versus English, essentially, Highland Scots versus the English army. And I said, we must have a lot of men in kilts because of the kilt factor. I like that. So if I think that perhaps I should introduce a female character here, too, to play off these men in kilts, and then we'll have a layer of sexual tension, and that will add to the conflict. So if I make her an English woman, then we'll have lots of conflict. So I decided I should have an English woman. This was about 3 or 4 days into the writing. And I didn't know who she was or what she was doing in the story or what her role would be other than to interact with all these men in kilts. And so I just loosed her into a cottage full of Scotsmen to see what she'd do. And so she walked in, looked around. Here were a bunch of Scotsmen squatting by the hearth, you know, obviously deep in conversation. They looked around at her. And I said, well, they're looking at her rather funnily. You know, I wonder what's wrong with her. But one of them sort of got up looking suspicious. And he said, well, how do you do? He said, my name's Dougal Mackenzie, and who might you be? And without my stopping to think much about it, I just typed, my name's Claire Elizabeth Beecham, and who the hell are you? And I stopped at that, and I said, well, you don't sound at all like an 18th century person. And so I fought with her for several pages, trying to beat her into shape and make her talk like a historical person, but she wasn't having any. She just kept making smart-ass modern remarks, and she also took over and started telling the story herself. So at that point, I said, well, nobody's ever going to read this book. It doesn't matter what bizarre thing I do. I said, go ahead and be modern. I'll figure out how you got there later. So it's all her fault that there's time travel in these
okay.
books.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, you know, the obvious approach, obviously, would have been to have taken everybody, you know, put them in that time period, uh-huh. and you would have uh-huh. had courage of the time
oh,
travel.
Yeah. Well, that's what I intended, but it just didn't work that way.
But I can see that, uh-huh. because, you know, probably your own natural narrative voice would really be clear.
Mm-hmm.
And in order for you to do what you're, you know, do the history and mm-hmm. yet use mm-hmm. your voice, mm-hmm. I can see why the time travel...
Well, yeah, it just seemed, you know, the easiest way to approach everything at that point. And I wasn't out to make problems for myself, since this was just a practice book.
Well, absolutely, uh-huh. but, you know, thinking it over, it also gives you a chance, because that's one of the things when we get to Fiery Cross here mm-hmm. in a minute that I so much enjoyed, is the fact that Claire is able to take what medical knowledge she could have had mm-hmm. from the 1940s.
That's right.
Uh-huh. For example, penicillin. Mm-hmm. You know, anybody mm-hmm. could have grown it even
yes.
then,
uh-huh.
even in Scotland, where it's called.
That's right. Uh-huh.
And so this gave you a chance, in fact, to take a lot of things mm-hmm. that you know that you couldn't really have put into an historical novel.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And uh-huh. make use of them.
Yes.
So you kept writing scenes and it all went along. How did it actually translate into a real book called Outlander?
Well, as I say, people began encouraging me to publish it, and I said, well, I don't even know what sort of book it is, and I said, and it's only for practice anyway. I said, but for the sake of argument, if I did want to publish it, what should I do next? And a lot of the published authors with whom I had become friends by this time said, well, you should get an agent. They said an agent can do two things for you. An agent can get your book read much faster than you can do by yourself, And then if you do sell it, an agent can certainly negotiate a much better contract for you than you could do, which is true. Literary contracts are just Byzantine. My first one was 12 pages long, full of clauses. And it's only owing to the perspicacity of my literary agent that I still own both my t-shirt rights and my action figure rights.
I always think of those. You mentioned that to me, and I thought people just do not realize the cluster of stuff that accrues around a successful book.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, nobody thinks of this. And many people, in fact, sign away all their rights for essentially nothing because they don't even realize those rights exist. Right. So, yeah, a literary agent is a good one. Is it worth his or her weight in gold?
Very true. So you got an agent.
Yeah, well, essentially I said, how would I find an agent? And they said, well, there's different ways. There's books, and there's organizations who keep lists and so forth. They said, but you know a lot of published authors who have agents. Why don't you just talk to them? I said, fine. So I began asking questions. Since I was nowhere near finished with the book, I just asked a published author whenever I was talking to them about anything. I said, oh, could you tell me, do you have an agent? And if so, where did you meet them? How does it all work? And so on. And they were very helpful about sharing information. And so I gradually began to zero in on this one man who I had heard a number of good things about, named Perry Knowlton. But I wasn't sure how to approach him because I had heard that he didn't take unsolicited queries. And I said, well, I'm not anywhere near finished with the book, so I can wait. Maybe I'll find another agent. Maybe I'll figure out how to approach him. So I just went on. And a few months later, I was talking to John Stith, who writes science fiction mysteries. And I asked him about agents. And he said, oh, yes. He said, by coincidence, mine is the same as so-and-so's. It's Perry Knowlton. He said, I know you're almost ready to look for an agent. Would you like me to write you a letter of recommendation? And I said, well, that would be really nice of you, John. So he did. And I followed that with my own query, in which I said, dear Mr. Knowlton, I've been writing and selling nonfiction by myself for the last 15 years. But now that I'm writing a novel, I understand I would really benefit from literary representation. And all these people whose opinions I respect have referred me to you. I said, I have this very long historical novel. Would you be willing to read excerpts from it? I didn't tell him I wasn't finished writing it. Excerpts were all I had. And so he called back and said he would. So I sent him a synopsis and my excerpts, and he took me on the basis of an unfinished first novel, which is not usual.
No, it's not, but of course it helps that you had delivered nonfiction.
Yeah, I could actually finish a book.
Right, and that's sort of the crux of the matter, really, is, you know, can you get from the proposal to the book?
That's right.
So he took you on and sold the book, and Outlander, now it's called Outlander here in England, as I remember it was published to the title Cross-Stitch?
Cross-Stitch, that's right.
What does Outlander mean?
Well, Outlander is basically a foreigner, you know, someone from beyond the borders of, you know, a tightly held home place. My working title for the book was Cross Stitch, which was sort of a feeble play on a stitch in time and, you know, the time travel crossing back and forth and a few other minor references. It's not a terribly good title, but it's what I was using as a working title. When Perry sold the book to the American publisher, though, they said, well, you know, this sounds too much like embroidery. Can you think of something more adventurous? And so we thought and thought and thought, and after months of exchanging lists of, you know, ever more ludicrous suggestions, I finally came up with Outlander. And they said, great, this will work fine. What they actually said was, oh, it's only one word. Good, it won't cover up the art.
Well, yeah, economy in book titles is a really good thing.
Yeah.
I noticed that the concordance to this series, which we published, was it 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Came out. It's called The Outlandish Companion.
That's right.
So there was kind of a play on things there. But also, if I remember, Jamie's term for Clary calls her Sassenach.
Yeah, he calls her Sassenach, which is the Gaelic term meaning outlander. And the Highland Scots traditionally, and even up to today, have used that primarily to designate English people, whom they have historically seen as, you know, invaders and generally intrusive influences. It's a very derogatory term, in fact, in general usage. And that's how he begins using it. But she, of course, doesn't understand this, being an English person. And over the course of the first book, he begins to use it as a term of endearment for her. And that's how it's continued. In fact, most of the people who have started reading somewhere other than the very beginning, and many who have and have forgotten, don't realize what it means.
Well, I was noticing when I was reading Fiery Crest that, you know, he refers to her by this kind of, as you say, term of endearment or pet name, as Sassenach. And since I am one, and I am aware that it is a pejorative term for people who are Scottish, who are Scots, sorry, that's another thing that's easy to go wrong. It is not Scottish. If you're a person, you're a Scot. I was aware, and I wondered if there was a double play here in your title, and clearly there is,
in various ways.
So you published that one in 1991, and then we moved on to your second book, Dragonfly and Amber, but that one came out really just a year later.
Yes, well, that's because it's not that I was much faster writing it. It's that the publisher sat on the first one for nearly 18 months trying to make up their minds how to publish it.
Ah, so you had time
And so
to
I was
complete.
writing on the second book because they did give me a 3-book contract.
Right.
As I said to Perry, I said, there's more to this story, but I thought I should stop while I could still lift it. So, you know, if anyone's interested, tell them there's more. And he did. And they said, well, trilogies are popular now. Could she write three?
I know, you're into the fifth book of your trilogy
well,
with at least one or two to come.
Well,
you
I
and
never
I...
said it was a trilogy.
I know, you and I have laughed at that over time. In fact, someone asked me the other night at a workshop for Peter Robinson, or asked Peter, rather, you know, how do you know when a book is done? And we were discussing it, and I volunteered. You weren't there. I said, well, I do know that Diana, her method for figuring out when she's ready to publish is when she can no longer lift it. And I said, it's a good thing, because I can't lift them either. The story really is just one story, unlike mysteries, where every book is discrete in the sense that it is a completely individual plot. You know, in a mystery novel, you may have characters whose stories transpose to the next book, but the plot is over with. But in your books, there are all kinds of plots, as you point out, worked in and scenes, and they're complete in and of themselves, but nevertheless, they really are all together, five-part story with, more to come. And the thing that makes them all work is the lives of Jamie Fraser and Claire Beecham.
That's right.
Do you intend this to stop when their lives are over?
Yes. Yeah, it's their story.
Yeah, exactly. Elizabeth Peters has said this about her wonderful characters, Amelia Peabody, and her husband, that it is really their books.
Yes.
And, you know, when we get to the end,
that's it. Yeah.
We're
mm-hmm.
it. Mm-hmm. So. You know, fortunately, they're not very old yet, so. In your book, so we have a way to go. Well, anyway, Dragonfly came in 92, and then the Voyager came in 1993. Is it
94.
Four? Okay, again, as a result
of this original three-book
this
contract.
Original thing. And then we went all the way to 1997 for Drums of Autumn.
Right.
And now it's been 4 years, although The Outlandish Companion came on. So is it... Has the slowdown been because the story keeps growing?
Well, in part, the story, as you can see from the books, is getting longer and more complex, both because the characters are getting older, they're leading more complex lives, they're also moving with the tide of history, which through the 18th century was getting more and more complex the closer you got to the American Revolution. And we're also involving some of the younger characters in a more major way. That is, the children of the original couple are now young adults and of an age to be, you know, seriously involved in the main plot lines, which of course causes additional complexities. Another aspect of this is just the engineering, which you mentioned in a way. That is, I could not be sure that people would encounter these as a series or even realize that they were a series. So each book is engineered to stand on its own and can be read as an independent novel. I mean, it's better if they start at the beginning and can encounter them because they do interweave with each other, but they are all meant to be separate books. And I've never wanted to be one of those authors who essentially repeats the same structure of a book over and over again, though in fact this is one of the better ways of becoming a rich and famous author is to do that. But I never did write to be rich and famous, so I wrote more for the challenge. And so each of the books is structured in a completely different way and uses different literary devices and approaches to do that. And this, of course, takes time. But perhaps the most important reason for the delay between books is that I inadvertently did get to, you know, at least a little bit more famous, if not totally rich yet. And once you become at all popular, people start wanting you to go places and talk about your books, which means that while no one was at all interested in hearing me come and talk about Outlander when it first came out, for Fiery Cross, I probably get enough invitations that I could be gone 2/3 of every month, you know, not even just weekends, but all the time.
Sure.
So, you know, you have to pick and choose and say no to a lot, but you still end up spending quite a lot of your time on the road or, you know, writing essays or introductions for other people's books or giving cover quotes. There's, I call it the third life. So everybody's got their first life. That's your family and, you know, your home and your hobbies, your religion, whatever you actually do during the day. Everybody's got that kind of life. Then if you're going to be a writer, you have to grow this whole second life, which is your interior solitary life, where it's just you and the book and the people in it. And a lot of people have trouble attaining a balance between these two lives. I know a lot of published authors who are divorced because they couldn't stay enough in the first life. They went too far that way. And I know a lot of people who have been writing their first novel for 10 years because they can't get far enough into the second world. So you, if you're a successful writer, you balance these two lives. Then if you become really successful, you get published and people begin liking your books, you grow a whole third life, and this is your public life. This is the things that are not writing, but are the things that you wouldn't do if you weren't a professional writer. And that's a big enough life that it could completely swallow you if you weren't careful.
In fact, it does a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It really, I think if you look back at Dashiell Hammett, he's a wonderful example of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he only had a very small body of published work, and
that's
then
right.
the movies and everything else, well, there were other things that intervened as well. Mm-hmm. But I call it the business of being a writer as opposed to being a writer. But it's absolutely true that it does swamp and trying to find your way among all those things. But also the baggage that every book accumulates. I mean, you start out with two characters, and then on we go. So what has been, because we're not in Scotland anymore in the Fiery Cross, we are in North Carolina, we are on the Fraser homestead. How did your characters move from Scotland across to America, which is where they're presently situated?
Well, I just followed the tide of history, which is that following Culloden in 1745, essentially the clan system in the Highlands was completely smashed. And the Highlands were desolated by the Duke of Cumberland's army. There was no more economy, minimal as that had been to start with. A great many of the men were dead. A good many more of them were transported as war criminals and sent to the colonies or to the Indies as essentially slave labor. Many of the women were driven out to starve, if not bayoneted on the spot. It was a terrible place. And a lot of people said to me after when we got into the third book, they said, "Oh, but I really like Scotland. I wanted you to write some more about Scotland." And I said, "Look, it's not the Scotland that you liked after 1745. They passed a law forbidding people from wearing the kilt, for instance. So no more men in kilts, no more bagpipes. It was a weapon of war and was thus outlawed." I said, it wasn't the Scotland that you fell in love with in the first two books, because the tragedy of the 45 was that died on that day.
It absolutely did. I've always thought that the Stuart monarchs were not only, they were unlucky. They had bad judgment. Yeah, they were. They had really bad judgment, and they didn't have any gift for picking subordinates.
None.
In fact, if you look at Culloden, if you go and take the tour of the battlefield, which I have done, which you probably have done as well, it's very clear that the generalship on the Scots side was just appalling.
Oh, yeah.
Picked the wrong ground, fought
criminal.
The wrong way, all of those things. So I've always thought, while it was really hard on the Scots who supported him, it was really good luck in general.
That he never became king.
Well, and interestingly enough, his father, James, the old pretender, who had come over in 1715 to chance his hand and then been defeated, and then Charlie, known as the young pretender, comes back in 1745. Charlie and his brother, Henry, both chose not to marry and not to reproduce.
Yeah.
So there would be no more Stuart heirs. So
that's
that
right.
the tragedy of 1745 was it.
That's right.
And I've always thought I had to admire that one thing they did. Henry became a priest, if I recall.
That's right. Archie became the Bishop of York.
Right. And Charlie, I think, actually married, didn't he? But he was childless.
Well, he did, yeah. Now, there is a certain amount of evidence that he did, in fact, have children, but not by his
illegitimate
wife,
children.
And therefore they were not heirs. Yeah.
Right, which is where the controversy started way back with James II and the warming pan baby.
Exactly.
Anyway, well, that's off our point. So anyway, so it isn't, staying in Scotland is probably not going to be
So it's not
happy.
Not happy. And so I said, what happened to the Highlanders who survived Culloden? What happened to them? Some of them were transported, as I said. Some of them existed in this perilous state. But a lot of them emigrated on purpose. Many of them had gone in the 1730s to North Carolina and were settled there. And so after the 45, a great many more went there too, because there they could find, if not direct kin, at least friends, people with a common background and a common language, because of course they were speaking Gaelic. And so this is where a lot of them went. And so I said, well, isn't that interesting? So I began looking at North Carolina, and sure enough, this is where one main stream of the Culloden survivors went. Another stream went to Canada, to Mackenzie, to Prince Edward Island. The Clan Mackenzie mostly went there, and we'll run into them in a future book.
Ah, good.
Mm-hmm. But here we're dealing with the ones who went to North Carolina, and there's a lot of documentation as to what happened to them after they went there. And so I said, well, this is where we should go. And as I looked further and further into North Carolina, I realized that this was one of the hotbeds of the pre-Revolutionary War era. In fact, there is a document called the Mecklenburg Declaration, which was published in 1775, a year earlier than the Declaration of Independence, but which espouses essentially the same principles.
Well, that's no surprise, is it? Mm-hmm. The other thing I think that probably made North Carolina appealing was the geography. I mean, it was a place in the New World that was not that dissimilar
No, it was
from
very
Scotland
much like
and
the
Scottish
Islands, yeah.
You
had remote mountains and And at the same time, the hunting was a lot better.
Right, but it was the Highlander, the mountain thing. Sharon McCrum has written, as you know, a lot about this same thing. And her most recent book, The Songcatcher, involves a boy who was taken from Islay.
Yes.
And brought over and to New Jersey, but eventually walked down to North Carolina.
Yeah.
And it isn't surprising, in fact, that so much of the pre-revolutionary fever grew there. So you've called the new book The Fiery Cross. Why?
Oh, well, it actually comes from an ancient Highland custom way back in the mists of antiquity, and no one knows where it started, but it was a well-entrenched custom in the Highlands. A clan chieftain who was preparing for a war of some kind would tie two sticks of wood together and set them on fire. The fire was then put out, usually with blood, sheep's blood, or with water if he didn't have a handy sheep. And the remnants were still called the Fiery Cross, and two clansmen would then be deputed to carry this cross through the glens and the quarries as a signal to the men of the clan to gather their weapons and, you know, come to the castle or the gathering place prepared for battle. And so that's what it is. It's a signal of oncoming war.
It's a wonderful, wonderful chapter in the book. But you've mentioned, I've digressed here for a moment, I meant to follow this other thread. Jamie and Claire have come to the New World, but Claire has she not made at least one trip back to the 20th century?
Yes.
And, well, fill us in. How did you handle the fact that she had a life before she fell into the 18th century, and she had to make a choice at some point about where she was going to live, didn't she?
I felt it not proper to tell her while she was being raised by this other man who had taken her as his own.
Right.
And so she reveals the truth, and through the agency of the daughter's boyfriend, who is connected to the story by other strands that I won't go into, he is a young historian who is fascinated by the story and begins delving into it at first to see if it's true, which he quickly discovers it is, but then he begins to discover evidence indicating that Jamie Fraser did not die at Culloden, which is, of course, a terrible shock to Claire. And they succeed in tracking him gradually through these brief appearances through history, and they finally locate a man who they think is Jamie Fraser in Edinburgh in 1766, which is the proper synchrony for Claire. If she were to go back here, that's where she'd land, is Edinburgh in 1766, if our theories of time travel hold.
Well, actually, one of the questions I was going to ask you is if she aged 20 years in the 20th century, did she similarly age, or if she goes back, she going to be younger? But if she's pregnant coming forward, I guess she has to be older going backwards, or you've kind of lost it, haven't you?
Yeah, no, according to the Gabaldon theory of time travel, you you continue along your own lifeline no matter which time period you're in,
so
and therefore you do age normally wherever you are.
Right, so you're going to send her back, not a young woman, but in fact a middle-aged woman. And a mother, and then Jamie is going to have actually missed the bringing up his daughter. And he hasn't, in the interval, presumably married or acquired, or have you done that to him? You don't want to tell.
I don't want to tell.
We've got
all
these. All right, so anyway.
Too many details there.
Too much of the mystery writer in us, both of us here, to do all that. So somehow, without going into it all, she does go back. And what happens to the child?
Well, the child is now a young adult, which is the only reason that Claire could bring herself to leave. In fact, the daughter forces her to leave, just as Jamie forced her to go. And the daughter says, you know, he gave you to me, I have to give you back to him.
Right. But doesn't the daughter eventually turn up?
Yes, she does, because she discovers something in her own researches that indicates to her, you know, a significant danger to her parents, you know, sometime in their future, in the later 1770s. And, you know, she has been feeling this strong pull toward this unknown man who was her actual father. You know, he did miss seeing her, and she missed seeing him. And now that she's learned he exists, she feels this strong, you know, urge to find him, and still more that both he and her beloved mother stand in this danger. She feels that she needs to get to them while there is still time, and so the danger might be averted. This is sort of a continuing question through all the books, is if you know something is going to happen, can you change it?
Right.
And if you can, or if you can't, why not, and what happens?
Well, actually, that's sort of the central moral question, don't you think, of all time travel?
That's exactly right.
And it's interesting the way that you have chosen to handle it, you know, because, I mean, other writers have tried it, and there are different kinds
Everybody
of theories.
Everybody has their own take on it.
I've always been really offended by people, you know, who, well, one of my favorite books along these lines is a book by Susanna Kersley called, what is it called, The Something Horses?
The Shadowy Horses,
thank you. I couldn't remember. Where in 20th century, what is it, Lower Scotland, Northern England, somewhere right up there in the border country, they go to visit the site of an old Roman legion camp. and there is a ghost from the past that comes in, and it is a Roman centurion. Now, in almost all time travel books, you're off the hook because you're in Scotland in the 18th century, and this is okay. Somehow, magically, this Roman centurion can speak,
talk to them, yes.
You know, and they can understand it. But in Susanna's book, the only person who can talk to this ghost of the Roman soldier is this little kid who's studying Latin, because the soldier...
Well, that's very sensible.
Yes, you know. And I think that that is one of the things that, that puts people off time travel books sometimes, is that they think there are going to be these conventions or devices, you know, that are just...
Which are silly.
And you know, you haven't got such a huge time period, and you're in people who are relatively in the language, so they can probably overcome it. But but I think you do wind up creating a kind of extra universe and extra morality, don't you, for this kind of thing? Which is also true of mysteries in a way.
Well, this is sort of the point here, is that it often occurs to you, you know, if this huge battle, which is going to cause the destruction of zillions of people you love, is about to happen, what can you do to stop it? If what you can do to stop it is a horrible, immoral act, should you still do it? That sort of thing.
Well, or if you stop it, then if you change the entire course of history, then where you were in the present before you went back to the past is not going to be real, or you've changed it. So. You know, it always seems to me that you really do have to work within the context of what actually happened.
Yes.
But if that's kind of universal and you're dealing with individuals, then presumably you can muck around with individual
lives.
Well,
that's exactly where it comes in, is this is what I say to people. They say, well, couldn't she stop the Battle of Culloden? And I say, well, only by doing this one particular thing. I said, she couldn't have stopped the rising as a whole, because this was the cumulative effect of hundreds and thousands of different people all working or pushing toward one end. You know, any event that you have in history is always the cumulative effect of multiple forces pushing on it from different directions. If it goes one way, it's because there was a prevailing mass of people and sentiment pushing that way. There may have been a few more pushing back, but they weren't big enough to overcome. So what is one person going to do? One person can't push against this, you know, overwhelming mass in order to repel an entire sequence of events. Now, if it's a single discrete event, say an assassination or something, that is, it may have large repercussions, but it is still an individual event, and therefore it could be affected by an individual, perhaps, or perhaps not. But no, you can't stop a, you know, the whole rising or something like that, or even a battle, most likely.
Very true. Well, anyway, so you've got them in 1771. They're in North Carolina when Fiery Cross opens, and we have, good for you, more conflict coming. We have the war building up and so forth. And that is, I gather, going to be the context for the next, you know, chunk of the story. I mean, we are not even into the war.
No,
at
not
the,
yet.
At the end of the Fiery
Cross. I was planning to
get
to the edge of the American Revolution, but as it is, I only got through 1772. Because in North Carolina, in 1771, there was an event called the War of the Regulation, which no one who did not grow up in North Carolina knows about or has ever heard of. But it was, in fact, sort of a dress rehearsal for the American Revolution, in that it was a taxpayer revolt against a royal governor who put it down by force. And it was very brief. There was only one battle, the Battle of Alamance, and you know, and then it was over. But it embodied a great many of the principles and the unrests that contributed to the revolution. And so for Jamie and Claire, who do know that the revolution is coming, this is something of a dress rehearsal for them. Because Jamie here is in an unusual position. He holds his land in North Carolina as a royal land grant, that is, it was given to him, you know, by the king, essentially, through the virtue of the governor. But that can be taken away again, of course, by the king. He knows the revolution is coming. When the revolution does come and reaches a certain point, the king is not going to have any power anymore. The rebels at that point, or the rebel government, will hold power. So he has an oath to the king of England. If he breaks that oath too soon, then he is a rebel. The British government will get him, you know, and he may be hanged and his lands confiscated, you know, and all of this destruction visited on his tenants and loved ones. On the other hand, if he waits too long and is perceived as a loyalist, the rebels will get him. And so the question is, where does he make his choice? You know, this is based on purely individual pragmatism. It's, there's no sense of idealism about it at this point. It's just, where can he make his move? And under what circumstances, and how can he affect the people around him so as to preserve as many of them as possible?
Absolutely. I mean, because it would come down to safeguarding what you can, you know, and the knowledge that you're not going to be able to prevent the whole. It's also kind of clear from this scene, and as you and I mentioned earlier today at lunch, that if the British had really paid attention, they could easily have won the war. I mean, winning the American Revolution was partly luck and partly skill, but a lot of it was just that the British didn't value what they had over here, and they didn't throw their best effort at it.
Yeah. Well, also they didn't perceive it initially as being a huge threat because, as I say, things like the War of the Regulation had occurred before and, you know, basically been put down by a governor who had just raised a militia. You know, he had no official troops, the governor of North Carolina. In fact, there were no official troops in the colonies at that point. They'd all gone home after the French and Indian War, and they only began to come back after hostilities broke out at the beginning.
There's some interesting analogies to where we are today. Thinking about, you know, the Afghan War and all, which has a long and historical context I wish we'd all pay attention to. One of the things about Claire, though, that's very interesting is that when she's gone back, she has taken her medical knowledge with her. Mm-hmm. Now, she doesn't have operating rooms and, you know.
No, but she has the knowledge.
Right. And so some of the scenes that I liked in Fiery Cross enormously is when she is either part of it's about pharmaceuticals, and part of it's about surgery, but there's a scene in which Jamie has a tremendously infected leg and looks like it's going to have to come off since amputation was basically all you could do at that point for gangrene and all.
That's right.
Claire has a different plan. Did you actually try this out, or did you just decide that somehow the plan that she comes up with would work? I wanted to ask you if you'd taken up snake handling.
No, but it's a technically feasible solution, the one that she comes up with. I mean, I was a scientist for a long time and a biologist, so I do know quite a bit about snakes and snake venom. And in fact, the problem, the point where she's addressing it, is no longer one of snake venom. You know, the venom has already done its work. It's a matter of secondary infection and how to deal with that. And she has been working through most of the book on her approach to penicillin, because of course she's come back with the knowledge of penicillin. She has memorized what penicillin looks like. She has a working microscope finally, and finally the leisure to, you know, try to evolve this. As people have been saying to me all through the books, well, why isn't she slapping moldy bread on people's wounds? You know, because they think moldy bread equals penicillin. And I said, well, because there's a lot of stuff on moldy bread that is not penicillin, and you probably don't want to go stuffing it into wounds. And the other thing is, they assume blue mold is penicillin, which is not. It is the organism Penicillium. Penicillin is actually a clear fluid that's secreted by this this fungus, essentially, is what penicillin is, Penicillium is. And it's the clear fluid which is penicillin. However, while it's effective, it's not very stable in its raw form, which means it won't last very long. And also, there are multiple strains of Penicillium, some of which are more active than others. It took 14 years from the time when Sir Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin and what it did to the point where it could actually be used in medical practice, because it was so difficult to purify and to make stable and then to produce in commercial quantities. And so while Claire does have the advantage of knowledge and so forth, still she's very limited in the sorts of equipment that she has and what she can do with it. And so her product is still not going to be at all predictable. Even when she makes what she thinks is a good batch of penicillin, she doesn't know how much active penicillin she has. She doesn't know how long it will be stable or even if it is active. You know, so she may just be sloshing meat broth on people to no effect.
Well, she could be. And then, of course, she has to come up with a delivery system, which is where the snake comes in. We don't have to detail all that. The other thing I thought was kind of fun was that she has this ferociously tidy housekeeper who's always throwing out, or at least at one point, you know, tidies up some of this moldy bread and other stuff and presents her with problems. But I would think, in a way, it's wonderful for Claire. She can save a lot of people. She can apply. But at the same time, it must be terribly frustrating, given the primitive way, comparatively speaking, she's working, to know that that she's going to lose people, lose patients.
Who could otherwise be saved.
Who could easily have been saved if she were, in fact, back in the 20th century all of this had come up. So, you know, I find that another really interesting quandary for her.
Well, that's one aspect of her morality or her moral dilemma. And at one point in most of the books, they discuss this. But in The Fiery Cross, they're mentioning, you know, the ability to change time or not change time, as the case may be. And I think as Jamie points out that, in fact, she does change time every time she saves someone who would otherwise have died. Because what about all the untold generations passing on from them? And she reflects half jocularly that perhaps she's contributing to the population explosion of the 20th century.
Well, she probably is. And you know, you are kind of, you know, bluntly speaking, you are kind of fudging that whole question then of how much do you affect what your solution, it seems to me, in part, is that, you know, you're not affecting the major events.
The historically recorded effects.
Exactly.
You certainly are affecting the ones around you.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the underlying point of the book throughout, is that time travel essentially gives you knowledge, but not necessarily power, or at least not power above what any person has in their own time, which is that every single action we undertake at this time has an effect, whether we know what it is or not, and often we don't know.
And it may be that one of the surviving, you know, somebody who mm-hmm. survives and then has progeny.
Yes.
That there's going to be, you know, 200 or 300 years mm-hmm. later, some person.
Some striking effect, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. wouldn't have existed. Right. Uh-huh. Well, tell me whatever happened to the mystery that you started out to write, now that we've digressed through five books with more to come.
Yeah. Well, as I said, I never said it was a trilogy to start with, but they did give me a three-book contract, and fortunately the first three books did well. So when I told them there was a fourth book, they were very excited and wanted to buy it. And so I said to my agent, well, I said, tell them they can have it, but tell them they have to give me a contract to write a mystery, too, because I really wanted to write a mystery. I said, this may be the only chance we have to blackmail them into it. And so he told them that, and they went away and thought, and came back and said, well, we'll give you a contract to write two mysteries, and then if the first one works, we'll have the basis of a series. I said, fine. So, in fact, I've had this contract for two mysteries for several years here, and have been sort of working on the first mystery in small bits and pieces in and amongst the other books and the other projects that I've undertaken. So I do, in fact, have you know, substantial chunks of the first mystery written. I had to sort of put it aside for the last 6 months in order to finish Fiery Cross and get it through the production period, but... Now I'm going back to that. Now the mystery is the next one up, so to speak. I usually do work on more than one book at a time, partly because I don't know where a book ends until I'm finished working on it. But that's going to be sort of my major focus of concentration once I finish with the book tour for Fiery Cross.
And of course that's partly because in order to write a mystery which is so heavily plot driven, you've mm-hmm. got to truly engage and keep it all in your mind. Mm-hmm. I know that you like writing in scenes and then, as mm-hmm. you say, stitching them all together
right.
and writing uh-huh. the bridges. Mm-hmm. But for a mystery, that'll be a tighter process.
It is much tighter because it's focused essentially on a crime. You know, even if it's a series of crimes, it's still very tightly focused. And even though you do have this intertwining of the plot strand with the character's private life, and luckily they intermingle, or it does if you do it right, even so, it's still very tightly focused here. You can't be going off all over the landscape.
Right.
So it will be a shorter book, I can tell you that much, but other than that, I don't know a lot about the final stages of writing it, because I haven't got there yet.
Can you give us an idea what you're exploring in it? I mean, you say it's a mystery, but does it have a particular
mm-hmm.
focus?
Yeah, uh-huh. It's sort of about obsession and revenge and so forth. The protagonist is a journalist, an investigative journalist. It begins in Philadelphia, where he is on the trail of someone who he suspects of having, you know, mob ties and being involved in something really dirty. The complication here is that the suspect's wife is the journalist's ex-girlfriend, you know, from many years ago, and they meet and rekindle an acquaintance, and this is how he gets wind of what her husband may be up to. She's unhappy with her husband for reasons we won't go into, and is inclined to take back up with the journalist. And so he is, you know, sort of encouraging her to come to him with anything she finds out about her husband. At the same time, he realizes that he doesn't want to restart a relationship with her, and so he's torn between, you know, trying to keep her at arm's length and still get what he needs from her. And this works to the point that she calls him up one night and announces that she has the definitive proof, all the documents that he needs. She's bringing them to him, but she also makes it clear that she's planning to leave her husband that night and run away with him and the documents. And so he goes to this rendezvous, you know, not knowing how to handle the situation. He really wants the story, but he doesn't want the woman. And how is he going to handle this without too much damage? When he arrives at the rendezvous, he finds her in her car with her throat cut. The husband has found out.
Well, you really
and it goes on from there.
You really learned your lessons well, kiddo. I mean, sexual tension. The only thing you're probably lacking in the mystery is the guilt factor, but mm-hmm. maybe you'll find a way to do that. Well, Diana, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Every time I do it, I learn new and fascinating stuff. One thing I would say about you, in fact, I wrote a little tribute to a science fiction convention you went to not long ago, in which I said that the thing I marvel about the most and all of the things about you that make me marvel is your ability to engage your left and right brains. It seems to me an equal strength. Most people don't seem to be able to do that. I mean, mm-hmm. most people seem to me are more right brain mm-hmm. or more left mm-hmm. brain, but you know, you have this amazing ability to take those two sides of yourself, you know, the scientist, the ruthless mm-hmm. scientist, and it really shows up in your books
yes.
and places. Mm-hmm. And then to take this imaginative, you mm-hmm. know, part where you can imagine relationships, do time travel, somehow you make it all work.
Well, I don't know how. You know, it's probably one of those things that you don't want to look too closely at, like sausage making.
I think that's true. I think it'd be best if we don't know. But let us congratulate you on it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Diana, for coming today. And I certainly thank all of you for joining us on the Criminal Calendar. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.